Hi, I'm Trevor Elio.
And I'm Julie Stern, and this is Conceptually Speaking, the show where we interview experts to uncover the concepts and patterns that help us organize our world.
From farming to fashion, we can understand any field through acquiring, connecting, and transferring conceptual relationships.
We hope this podcast will inspire teachers and students to design creative solutions to complex problems and accelerate innovation in today's schools. If you're interested in our work, you can find out more at edtosavetheworld.com.
On this week's episode of Conceptually Speaking, Julie and I chatted with Joaquin Tamayo, a senior policy advisor at the Education Council, who looks to leverage the science of learning to create more equitable systems for students through research and policy. What I loved about this conversation was Joaquin's ability to take some of education's oldest truisms, things like the importance of relationships, understanding why learning environments matter, and seeing ways that the education system is broken, and provide keen insight into the deeper why. If we hope to create systems and policies that truly serve the best interests of their students, understanding these deeper causal mechanisms is a vital piece of repairing the education puzzle. Luckily, we have folks like Joaquin who are working to synthesize systems thinking and scientific knowledge to advocate for policy that helps all students feel the sense of belonging they deserve.
But we can't underestimate how fundamental a feeling of belonging is to this entire project that we call education. And there is no positive learning and development without that feeling of belonging. Really for all of our kids. So when a feeling of belonging is absent, then one, we can't attend to the young person's individuality and what they're bringing, you know, to the table. They're not going to feel comfortable, letting the adults who are responsible for their learning and development know the full context of what it is that they are experiencing, so that, you know, that adult can then come to them with the right level of support, the right kind of approach.
To show just how good this episode was, it clocked in at a whopping hour and 10 minutes. So it might take a few sittings to get through, but it's worth the extra helpings. It's chock full of insight, and we hope you enjoy.
Our guest this week is Joaquin Tamayo. He is a senior policy advisor at a Washington, D.C. consulting firm called Education Council, where he helps to lead the Science of Learning and Development Alliance, whose goal is to promote and elevate the science of learning as a driver of equity and excellence for all kids. Welcome, Joaquin.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
We're excited to have you. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you do at the Science of Learning and Development Alliance?
Sure thing. The Science of Learning and Development Alliance is a national collaboration among a number of leading education organizations in this country, whose mission it is to elevate the important findings from the science of learning and development so that we can help shift mindsets across the country, particularly the mindsets of our system leaders, who really need to do the hard work of transforming our system so that we can actually achieve equity and excellence in this country. And so what we do is we convene those leaders, we provide them with accessible knowledge, coming from the Science of Learning and Development Alliance, and we help them think through how they can use that knowledge to influence practice and policy at all levels of the system.
That's so awesome. So full disclosure to our listeners, Joaquin and I go way back on a number of different projects. We worked together at Cesar Chavez Public Charter School for Public Policy many moons ago. And then we also worked with each other at the Stanford Children's Kindness Challenge. I'm super excited to have you on the show, not only because I consider you a friend, but also because we've had a number of guests talk a bit about the science of learning, such as Oliver Cavalioli. And we've had several guests speak about equity. And so when we approached Joaquin, we said, you know, what could we, you've done school leadership, you've done research, you've done so many different things, you've worn a lot of different hats. And so he said, I'd love to talk about how the science of learning sort of meets equity. And so that's a really exciting conversation. I think we're going to get a lot out of this. And so we always ask our guests if they could boil down their field. So they have premises that we are not experts in the science of learning and equity in the way that you are. So could you boil down your field to sort of three main ideas? And so you did that before we started recording. Do you mind sharing with our listeners, what are your three ideas? And then we'll sort of unpack them one by one.
Sure thing. The first big idea that we really focus on at the SOLD Alliance, so that's our acronym, SOLD, not the prettiest name in the world, but we call ourselves the Sold Alliance. And so we try to focus on three things in the work. One is really being strategic about how we shift mindsets, particularly of educators, but of any, you know, interested and concerned citizen, in terms of what they think they know and what they should come to know about how the brain and the body learn and develop in context. So lots of mythology that still undergirds much of our system that really needs to be reconsidered if we're going to be able to shift and do, you know, what's going to end up being a lot of hard work to ensure that all kids are equitably educated in this country. So that's number one, really focusing on shifting mindsets. Number two is, you know, equity is a word that has been used in lots of different ways, and it right now it's having a moment in the sun, which I think is really good. But the real work of centering equity within systems that were not designed to, in fact, I would say they were designed to create inequity at their core is something that is not well understood by, I would say, most educators. And not that we're the experts in that, but what we're trying to do is ask the hard questions and put the hard issues on the table that can get us, if we have a mindset shift about how the brain and the body learn and develop in context, we can begin to think about what are the implications of that knowledge for redesigning, deconstructing, transforming our systems so that all children, particularly those at the margins, really have never been affirmed and valued and served well by our systems, are in the middle of it. And we design for them, because if we can design for them, then learning for everybody else is actually going to be not only equitable, but high quality at the same time. So that's point number two. And then point number three, and it's just, you know, we're all familiar with the notion of, like, you know, going viral these days in more ways than one, no pun intended. But that happens when you build a critical mass of people who are aligned, who see each other, who speak the same language, and who are all, you know, really pushing in the same direction. And that's how you get the kind of, not just, you know, sort of technocratic systems transformation, but cultural change, you know, whereby everybody just, it's common knowledge that, of course, we educate people this way because that's what's good for them and that's what's fair and that's what's right and equitable. And beneficial to society, right? And so we need to build a critical mass, and we're starting with the leadership of, you know, our education systems in this country. That's our particular mission, you know, to get them to really, you know, think about how they can take this knowledge to their own constituencies, to their own stakeholders and, you know, communities, organizations and systems, and really begin to, you know, push and scale for this kind of transformation, because without leadership, we don't have change in this country. So, you know, those things, shifting mindsets, centering equity, and building a critical mass to do the hard work.
Yeah, those are really, really big words. We could have like multiple podcasts on each one of those. And so I'm wondering if you could give an example of your first one about mindsets. I can think off the top of my head, one thing that drives me bonkers is that we still think intelligence is innate and that the brain doesn't really change. You know, once you're in kindergarten, you know kids' abilities, quote unquote, their intellectual abilities. And it just drives me nuts. I can't believe we still say things like, oh, my high kids, my highs and my lows. I mean, would that be an example, or do you have any other sort of examples of things that people think that are not indeed backed by science?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the right question. So what we do in part at the Science of Learning Development Alliance is taken this tremendous body of knowledge that is generated from across many different fields of research into what we might call the learning sciences, but also the sciences of human development. Because, you know, our brain and is nested within our body, and it's actually, you know, learning and coming to positively developing as a human being is a full body experience. And so actually that's sort of one of the mind shifts, let's just go here for a second. That's one of the mindset shifts that we're trying to promote, which is to say that, you know, the body isn't just this caring device that, you know, young people bring with them, you know, and they holding their brain to class. And that's all that school is, you know, really about. It really is about all of the stimuli that a young person is experiencing, and understanding how that works, and understanding, for instance, that relationships, the relationships that we build in our lives, that we encounter, that we're provided with, that we lose, that we regain, those relationships are the primary driver of learning. And that is not very common knowledge among educators, and certainly not among the general populace. And so I'll say a little bit more about what I mean by that. So one of our experts, you know, one of the leaders of the Science of Learning Development Alliance, is Pam Cantor. She's the founder and senior science advisor of an organization called Turnaround for Children, based in New York City. And she likes to say, or she likes to help people understand how, as she puts it, how experience, our experiences, including our learning experiences, get under the skin. How do we take these experiences, and how do they actually physiologically change the brain such that we create those synapses and those neural pathways that promote the learning we want to see in kids? And that is a whole biological, neurological process that is grounded in the relationships that we have with people who are teaching us, and the people that we're learning with. All of that is mediated through relationships. So, you know, just think back to, you know, for most people, right, those handful of educators who really made that powerful difference. And, you know, we happen to remember what they taught us. And the reason why is because we had that relationship, not necessarily because the content was any better than the content that other teachers were trying to teach, right? But when you have that relationship whereby your brain and your body come to a place because there's psychological safety, there's a sense of belonging, there's trust, your brain isn't allowed to take in that information and then do all of the hard cognitive work that it takes to actually learn something, including being able to persist, being able to take risks, you know, with that information, right? Being okay to make mistakes, and all of the things that we know as educators that it takes for a young person to really come to learn something, all of that happens in the context of a relationship. And so that's one of the powerful mindset shifts that we're trying to promote here, because relationships have been treated, I would say, since the founding of the Common School, really as incidental to the task of teaching and learning. That if you know you have that, if you have those handful of teachers that build that strong relationship, well, good for you, right? But that really wasn't part of the design of the system. That, you know, first principle, let's make sure that what we have in the school building is a network of incredibly strong and trusting relationships as the foundation for instruction. And so we really want to sort of flip the script in helping people understand you know, what the science is saying about the actual drivers of learning and development, not, you know, the way we think about it now, assessments, accountability, sort of surveillance right, of right. our young people. That's not yeah. what's driving
yeah.
it. And so really excited to help promote what I frankly believe is just some really revolutionary knowledge that can change, you know, the lives of all of our kids.
Could you talk a little bit about what are some of the things that help create or establish those relationships? Because I feel like I hear the word relationship a lot when I see the word relationship a lot on social media, but it's sort of like this kind of like hashtagable thing. And in some cases, it's even framed in, I don't want to say in opposition, but in competition with instruction. Like, I care more about relationships than I do about, you know, thing X, Y, or Z. Whereas I like the way that you said that, having that relationship, to my eyes, sort of creates this loose way that helps students learn. I see those things as inseparable from one another. The relationship provides the opportunity. It provides the context to have meaningful learning experiences. I don't see like one, you know, disrupting or interrupting the other. They both sort of feel necessary. So could you talk a little bit about what are some of the things that lead to meaningful relationships that do affect and impact students' ability to learn?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and it's interesting. I my mom is a former teacher, and you know, I'm explaining to her what I do, and got jazzed, for instance, talking about relationships, and she started teaching in 1981, and I owe everything that I know about education really to the foundation that she laid for me, and also, you know, in becoming a teacher, how she helped me understand the craft and get better at it. So I'm talking about relationships, and she says to me over FaceTime, "Really? Like, I've known that since 1981. Like, what is new here?" Like, yeah. So those of us who frankly, I'll say, who are effective as educators, we know this. And I think, well, even probably those who are not so effective, they know that relationships are key. It's not, a secret. But again, when you think about how our systems are designed to either support or undermine those relationships, I think you can come to, understand that, most people get it at a visceral level. They also know that it's just not necessarily something that is used, in as I would say an effective way as possible, to educate all children, not just the kids that Julia, I think you're kind of referring to, the kids I like, the kids I get along with, and all those kids that I don't, c'est la vie. and that's just, we wouldn't say that, it would be okay if, black mold in a classroom, and try not to inhale too deeply, right? But when we have situations like before the pandemic, but lots of schools that were with really toxic environments where kids were struggling to motivate to come to school in the first place and stay in school and deal with those types of systems, we're talking about a fundamental breakdown of the structure of relationships within that school. And I certainly have been in those schools, and I know what that looks like. And when I think now about how acceptable that was to so many people, right, or how easily people were resigned to that fate, right? But when you really know that there is no learning and development without strong relationships, you sort of, like, it scales falling from your eyes. And then I think you're able to approach, complicated situations and complicated environments with a new perspective, and thinking about it differently. And it doesn't have to be shame or blame, and it's not win or lose and pass or fail and all of the dichotomous ways that our systems are designed. And so that's what I think is really fundamental. But back to your question about what do we know about building strong, trusting relationships? It's the good news is it's not that hard to do, right? Right now we are all engaging in an activity that is having a neurological, physiological impact in our brain, right? Like, there are synapses that did not exist 2 minutes ago now already will forever be permanent in our brain, which is like phenomenal. I love getting into the technical aspect of that, for sure. But that's, we don't have to like bother too many people with all of that. If you're interested in it, that's cool, right? But there are a few things that every educator should do if they want to build a strong trusting relationship with any kid. Number one, and this is another one of our key findings of the Science of Learning and Development Alliance, is understand that the brain and the body of every young person that you're interacting with is malleable for the entirety of their lives. So this goes back to something that you said a little while ago, Julie. Most people, I would say, have a very fixed mindset about not only intelligence, but about the capacity of the brain to grow and to do anything beyond a certain limit. And with that, really incorrect, understanding of malleability, we make lots of us make casual decisions about who can and who won't, right? And once you go there in the first instance, there's no positive relationship that you're going to build from that that's going to further any young person's learning and development. That's point number one. So understanding that every young person that you come to contact with is malleable and can, from whatever their developmental point is at that moment in time, can be guided and shaped and nurtured and cultivated, given the right sets of experiences and environments in which they can productively struggle and learn and master whatever their goal is, right? So one, just understand that they're malleable. Two, understand that every young person is an individual, and their learning path is going to be as unique as a snowflake. No two brains are alike. No two individuals are going to make meaning of their relationships and their environments and their experiences in quite the same way. And so when you appreciate that, you can understand that how they are experiencing this relationship is really all about what you're putting into that relationship, right? Like, you know, you own that. That is your power that you carry as an educator. So understanding that a young person is malleable and understanding that, you know, the affect that you're receiving from that young person is a direct response to what you are putting into this relationship, you know, and it's not everybody else and it's, you know, not me, I think is a really also sort of powerful, you know, understanding. I think often when educators struggle, they resign themselves like something I can't do anything about this kid, or I can't, you know, but when you understand actually, no, you can do something. And you can always do something, right? Because, you know, fundamentally that young person is malleable and just waiting, frankly, for positive, you know, interactions, you know, with people. And then I think the last thing I'll say is that, and this is, you know, I think becoming, it's more in the water now that social emotional learning is really, you know, receiving the important focus that it's getting. But all learning, all cognition is social and emotional, right? Like the brain integrates all of these experiences, relationships, and environments. It doesn't separate them into academics here, social emotional learning over there. It's all one whole experience for that young person's mind. So when you understand that, whether you're, you know, trying to help them, you know, deal with the loss of a loved one and build a relationship in that regard, or trying to help them understand, you know, the consequences of the Holocaust, so the brain's actually taking in all that information the same exact way. And so, you know, when you understand you can't sort of tease these things apart, and that however you're interacting with a young person, you know, that is fundamentally, you know, grounded in the nature of that relationship and the quality of that experience, you know, then I think we can begin to cultivate those mindset shifts that are really going to get us to the most powerful teaching and learning possible.
I love that you're saying about how we can make a difference. And I do see that even for something as Trevor saying, like relationships is hashtaggable. But I was scrolling through Twitter one day and I saw this tweet. I didn't like it because it's like one of those sort of really sad tweets. And the only option you have on Twitter is a heart. So you're like, oh, I'm not sure if I should be like, yes, this is a great tweet. But I want to share it because it stopped me cold in my tracks. A teacher tweeted that one of her students, didn't come to class that day to the Zoom class, and they're doing remote learning. And she said, she called him up and she said, you know, she said, why didn't you come to class? And he said, number of teenager reasons, it's boring, or I didn't want to, my alarm clock didn't go off correctly, or, you know, I was having trouble connecting. And then she said, 10 minutes into the conversation, he said, my uncle's in ICU and my dad's got a sore throat. And she tweeted, there it is. And I mean, it stopped me cold because that, you know, it takes 10 minutes. So it does, you know, if you've got 200 students, then that's nearly impossible for you to have that level of conversation. It's almost targeting those kids, and it shifts. I found, you know, as a teacher, it shifts which kids need me the most. You know, you've got your handful that need you the most all the time. Mm-hmm. But it kind of, you know, you can see like this kid who's normally got it together today, I can see something's not right. So I know I need to check in with that kid. And sometimes it takes, you know, 10 minutes into the conversation where you find the thing that's really sort of holding that kid back, worrying them, that can help you get to the heart of why they didn't come to class or why they didn't turn an assignment or whatever it is. And having some of that empathy for kids, I think, is enormous.
Yeah. No, so one thing I'll add to what I just said, and this is related to the relationships and the experiences point, but we can't underestimate how fundamental a feeling of belonging is to this entire project that we call education, right?
So into that.
Yeah, and there is no positive learning and development without that feeling of belonging, you know, really for all of our kids. So when a feeling of belonging is absent, then one, we can't attend to the young person's individuality and what they're bringing, you know, to the table. They're not going to feel comfortable letting the adults who are responsible for their learning and development know the full context of what it is that they are experiencing, so that, you know, that adult can then come to them with the right level of support, the right kind of approach, right? The everything from, you know, the affect of one's voice to, you know, we're going to activate the system to get you the resources or the interventions or whatever. It's the whole spectrum, of what the adults in the system is bringing to the table. And again, when you think about, Julie, you just mentioned, how many teachers in this country have hundreds of kids, right, on their daily roster? The reason why we're so focused on systems transformation is actually because there is no way for a teacher with that type of student load to build trusting relationships with every single one of those young people. In fact, the system is not designed to do that. It is designed absolutely 180 degrees, in the opposite direction. We really have to, begin to be okay with thinking about a fundamental redesign of that structure, because the needs of that young person who, took as long as he did to let, the adults responsible for him know what was really going on in his life, right? Just imagine all the kids, who don't have those relationships, who aren't being connected, in that way, and all of the contexts that we're not understanding and then can't address. And that's by design. That's not a mistake of the system. That's intentional, because our system is designed to funnel kids and to sort them, for purposes of, what I would say is a pretty, at this point, barbaric notion of social efficiency that cuts across racial and class and gender and all kinds of lines in ways that really do put our kids in this kind of pyramid structure out of which they really can't break.
We had a team meeting where we talked about, I'm not going to tell which of our teammates, because we've got a pretty big team, said that, they encounter teachers regularly who really, really think their grades have to be on a curve. I was like, are you serious? That is still a thing. Apparently it is still a thing where some teachers really feel that their grades must be, their spread must be on a curve. Mm-hmm. Otherwise they're not being tough enough or rigorous enough or I think you've got a lot of work to do, with the shifting mindsets. I'm reminded of Young Zhao was on our podcast, who said, you know what? I'm not worried about the people who are listening to this podcast. I'm worried about the teachers who are not listening to this podcast. And because, that's the thing, is that people who are going to take their free time to listen to a podcast about teaching probably are the ones who are building the relationships. And so really, I think it's really wonderful that you're working with leaders. I'm sure that popped into Trevor's mind as a teacher who says, you know what, sometimes the toxic culture is not from student to teacher, but from teacher to student, I should say, but from the teacher to teacher and leader to teacher. And so I'm reminded of one of our guests, Jenny Donahue, who talked about collective efficacy, about that building of that trust among the adults. And that's guess what? That's the number one factor that influences student achievement, according to John Hattie's meta-analysis of things that impact student achievement, whether or not the adults in the building have a high degree of trust and a high degree of belief in their ability to move students. What do you guys do as far as leaders getting them to maybe reflect on their relationship building, not only with students, but also with teachers? Do you guys focus on that at all?
We do. I mean, so in addition to providing them with this information and creating a space in which they can grapple with it and ask, in a safe space in which they can ask hard, tough questions of their own work, not just of the system, in an abstract way. But we also work, to cultivate the relationships among those leaders, right? And we speak very, right, absolutely. And we speak very directly about, we sort of put ourselves on the balcony a little bit and say, look at what we're creating here, right? Appreciate the work that we're doing to cultivate the relationships that are you know, one day going to result in this aha moment about something that is important to do. And you're going to have this relationship with one of your colleagues, you know, across the country in the SOLD Alliance. And we're going to create that pathway, that accessibility, that sense of belonging between, you know, the two of you or however many are, you know, are let's say, you know, want to collaborate, understanding that that is the basis of the ideation and of the innovation that you're going to have to do to accomplish whatever your goals are. And again, that is all centered, you know, in this notion of a relationship. So we're trying to, you know, walk the walk as much as we talk the talk, and, you know, not become those education elites who are, you know, just telling people, you know, what they need to do, without either, you know, modeling that or demonstrating what we mean by that in our own practice and in our own work. Because that, you know, that doesn't create a sense of belonging. That turns off people, right? Mm. And we know that. So we don't want to repeat those mistakes. And again, you know, in a small way, another one of those mindset shifts in terms of, you know, how we want to engage educators and the field. Although we're working with field leadership in our alliance, at the moment, you know, we're very mindful that this is not a top-down project. This isn't, you know, the one right way, right? This is about trying to speak and spread the truth about how the brain and the body learn in context, or brain and body develop and learn in context, and then, you know, empower leaders and their communities to really take that information in, you know, leverage what's working in the work, and there's a lot that's going well, and then also, you know, reconsider all of that which is not working for kids, again, particularly all those kids at the margins.
And what would you say are some of the most common hurdles that you encounter? It's really fascinating to hear you say that the systems and structures of education are not set up in a way that is conducive to form relationships. However, relationships are also a vital part of learning in general. I think that's it's a fascinating tension. And it's one that I definitely have seen just in my own work. It's very clear that when students have that sense of belonging and safety, that the learning environment and experiences are so much better. But the idea that our system is set up in such a way where you have to work against the grain to create and establish and forge those relationships is something that I hadn't really considered. I've definitely thought about ways that makes it harder, but the idea that it was not constructed for that purpose is a fascinating one. So could you talk about, because of those systems, what are the ways that, I guess some of the issues it manifests that you find are common hurdles when you are trying to speak to leaders and speak to teachers and speak to policymakers about what we can do to fix those systems?
I would say probably the hurdle of all hurdles from my perspective is this sense, you know, even among folks who may agree with, you know, how I see the world, right, and see the challenge of our systems, that the problem is just so big and it's so complicated, and, you know, it's how could we really change it? How could we really upend the system, right? You know, there's an inference that, you know, what kind of chaos would we create if we really tried to deconstruct really what's wrong with our systems and build something even, you know, radically new that at this moment we can't even imagine what that might look like. It's that fear of you know, really, you know, rethinking, you know, from soup to nuts what this could be for all young people. And I would say that is probably, to my mind, the most fundamental hurdle out there. And it's paralyzing. It leads so quickly to a sense of resignation and alienation and defeat. And I just, you know, it really concerns me, because once you're in that place, there's it's really hard to get out of that kind of, you know, almost a depressive state about, you know, what's going on. And certainly these days, as we're all quarantined and, you know, education has been turned upside down for 50 million public school students in this country, you know, and everybody else, it's only gotten harder to you know, really rethink. Except that, you know, right now, you know, maybe this was in a weird kind of way, the moment that we've all been waiting for, And there's probably been no better time, at least in my lifetime, than now to begin to engage in the hard work of really rethinking, not just like the systems, but at an individual level, like what we can do, even what small thing that we as individuals can do to begin to, you know, flip the script and begin to, you know, be that one flap of a butterfly that creates, you know, the storm which just transforms the landscape. And, you know, so I think there's just lots of potential that gives me hope. But it's that sense of doom and resignation, and the problem is just too big to even start, which is probably the biggest hurdle to making progress.
I think that's a nice segue to your second sort of concept of centering equity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just first shifting mindset, second centering equity, and it not being, I assume that means it's not an afterthought. It's not like, okay, let's design our schedule. We've got English for an hour. We've got math for an hour, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And now what about equity?
what about equity?
You know, I sort of just as on a tiny scale, I want to share this little success story since you just talked about like how much of a big of a problem it is. But I just, my team and I just created this resource document where we've just collected a bunch of resources, and, you know, teachers typically like them somewhat divided around subject areas. And so when I first started creating the Google Doc, I have to be honest, equity was at the bottom. I had this whole chart about resources for access and equity. And I was like, screw this, you know, copy paste, cut and paste. And I put it right up at the top. And so that's just like a tiny thing. And then among the disciplines, normally I start with English language arts, mathematics, because that gets all the attention. And there are legit more English language arts and mathematics teachers in the country than all the other subjects. And so just for, you know, ease of the most people's eyes on the document, I usually put those at the top. But I said, social emotional learning is the first row in the sort of discipline specific. And so that's just like a quick example. And I feel like there's small things we could do to, as you say, sort of center equity in our work instead of making it be, oh yeah, don't forget, here's some stuff in case you want to think about equity. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit more about that concept, centering equity?
Sure. And I really love the example that you laid out. And you know, everybody at whatever level of the system is going to, quote unquote, center equity in a different way. And it's going to mean something different. And it's going to look different. And, you know, depending on where you are and who you're working with and, you know, the language that you're engaging people with, you know, it's all going to be a really sort of unique undertaking, I think, in lots of ways. But there's some core principles that I think cut across, you know, all of these, you know, individual efforts, however big or small they might be. And, you know, the one that I think you just, you know, seized on, Julie, is the ability to in the moment to rethink a choice. In the moment to rethink a structure that is going to enable or disable people from actually doing that work, and it is in some ways as simple as, you know, taking a row from the bottom to the top of the list. When you understand, you know, how the brain is going to consume that structure, and when you ask the brain to consider something as number one, mm-hmm. It processes it differently than if it's at the bottom of a list. It's just a cognitive neurological, you know, fact. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, and I'm making a connection, Trevor, with what you asked about how to build like relationships. Right. And, you know, imagine if, you know, you had a new crop of teachers and instead of saying, you know, to them, well, you know, here's all your content and go figure out relationships, you know, whenever you can, however you can, and hopefully you don't quit the job before you do, right? That like the first thing you're doing is relationships. That's mm-hmm. the first thing you're doing, right? And, you know, when you begin to, you know, move structures around like that, you actually, you know, can have some pretty big catalytic, you know, impacts. And it's not hard, but you do have to remember those principles of, you know, really, you know, thinking about, you know, where that work is coming in. And if it's always, you know, off to the side, or, you know, it's siloed and secluded, and it's not the overarching, you know, principle and purpose of the work, then it's really hard to center equity. And, you know, so I think it really is about, you know, creating those conditions, you know, for educators and everybody else to pause for a second, ask the hard question, where is equity, you know, in this work? What does that look like? How is it going to be operationalized? And then, you know, making the hard choice, you know, because sometimes, you know, you do have to make trade-offs, you know, in this work. And I think it's about time that we started to trade, you know, other less important, you know, matters for an increased focus on equity and really, you know, think about it, you know, that way if we're going to make progress.
I like the way that you talk about taking equity work and sort of baking it into the cake of what we do during teacher education, not having it be something that's added onto the side. Because I think that one of the problems is, you know, if you look at a traditional course, it is that content in the abstract. Whereas when you enter into that classroom, it is that content in a system of relationships. And it doesn't just exist in this abstract, you know, decontextualized space. Like the way that you think, talk, feel, whatever about your content area changes when you're in front of a room of students, right? Because if you're trying to relate it to their prior knowledge and understanding their experience, the way that you approach that content is going to change. So I think that's a really powerful and interesting idea of, you know, how can we not make relationships an afterthought or something that we just say, like make a relationship and actually think about how can we better integrate that into the process of learning about teaching. So I think that's something that's kind of missing. And, you know, I've sort of noticed that some of my best moments in class is when I'm able to think about the content from the view or the perspective of my students and think about what can this afford them? How can I get them to invest? And I've moved away from, you know, sort of just trying to engage in and excite them with things that, like, you know, when I first started teaching, I was really good at, I was like an excellent pig makeup artist. You know, I could take like an ugly, boring unit and dress it up in memes and videos and make it fun and funny. But it's much more powerful, I believe, to think about how can I get my students to really not just be engaged, but invest and see what this content has to offer them. So then they can, and that become the sort of third space where we can construct a relationship together because we have this shared thinking. So I think that's really powerful notion. Are there any like programs or activities or things that you guys sort of or I guess workshop structures that you run people through to begin thinking about how those relationships sort of look in class and how they integrate with the process of instruction?
I think, sure. And it starts with, actually in our work, it's interesting, Julie, lots of things that we did, you know, 10 years ago when we worked together, are now the, you know, some of the new, advisory. Oh, let's talk about advisory. Let's, you know, this actual structure that is a part of the fabric of the school day where the fundamental purpose is to construct a network, a web of strong, trusting, developmental, you know, relationships, you know, for all young people, and that everybody, you know, gets to be a part of this. And, you know, so we're trying to, you know, have, you know, conversations about structures that we know work, right? And elevate the roles of people in the school building who, unfortunately, you know, when it comes to budget cuts and quote unquote the tough choices that system leaders have to make are the first to go, counselors, school aides, paraprofessionals, you know, family engagement workers and the like, you know, all of these, you know, individuals who frankly are the ones who are primarily focused on maintaining and building these relationships in our school buildings, right? And oftentimes the individuals with whom our young people have the closest bond and the ones they go to for support, it's, you know, often not our teachers and certainly not, you know, administrators, or, you know, at least in a lot of cases. And so it's just interesting, you know, we're trying to, you know, reinforce for our system leaders that, you know, and again, that takes, you know, the ability and the willingness to pause, rethink how things have been done before and make a decision not to do things like that again. And then think through, you know, the implications of those choices. And, you know, imagine if a district, you know, how radical it would be if a district superintendent said, yeah, we have some budget cuts, we're going to make some tough choices, but I'm going to keep all my paraprofessionals who are working one-on-one with kids, and maybe we're going to have to lose a few math teachers. Like that would be a real disruptive, you know, choice that actually, you know, could be, you know, valuable in the long run when you're thinking about, you know, again, centering equity and understanding, you know, how critical relationships, rich instructional experiences and the environments, in which kids are learning are to the actual, you know, the task of learning and development.
I'm so glad you mentioned advisory because that's such a good solution to our problem we posited earlier of especially secondary teachers having so many students. And you mentioned advisory when you and I worked together. So what we did was we had everybody in the building, including all of those people you named, had advisees, and that allowed the numbers to be really small. And I had 11 students. I remember I was in classroom 207. I was just going in my head real fast. It was classroom 207. I can remember it exactly. I know my 11 students. This was, 12 years ago? And I'm friends with all of them on Facebook. And now I see them with their own husbands and their own kids and et cetera. Okay. But it was not hard to keep track of 11 kids and what was going on. What were their grades like? What was their attendance like? What was going on in their extracurriculars? That was not terribly difficult. And so, there are creative solutions. So anytime we sort of bring problems up, there are creative solutions out there. So thank you for bringing that up. Gave me all these warm, fuzzy memories of my kids who at the time were teenagers and now they're not, but it's now they're adults, and it's excellent that I still have relationships with those kids.
Yeah.
Now I call them kids, but you know. go ahead, Jared.
This might be a pivot to a new concept. So but you're seeing something earlier that was kind of like sticking out to me, which is another, I think, sort of like myth that's out there, just because we have this very Cartesian mind-body split when we think about learning. And it was very fascinating to hear you say how the mind and body learn and develop in context. So could you talk a little bit about that, like that bodily way of knowing or that embodied cognition? Like, what does that mean? I think that's a piece of the puzzle that maybe isn't really in the water. Like, I think that, like, you know, people will say like, oh, I'm like a kinesthetic learner or something like that. But like, it's sort of like a superficial pop version of what is actually something, I think, much more deep and complex. So could you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Sure. And it's something that frankly, since I started this work a couple of years ago, I've come to, you know, speak in this way, because I really want to, you know, reinforce the point that we're not just talking about the brain, right? Like, the brain is our central processing unit, if you will. But again, it is nested within a body that is receiving stimuli from all parts of our body, from our toes, you know, to our head, and from all of the environments in which we're moving, you know, in the world. And the meaning that we make of those experiences and those environments will shift from environment to environment and from relationship to relationship, right? So it's, you know, we really want to help people understand that it's not this sort of static thing. The brain is always doing the same thing in the same way, regardless of what's going on. It's actually incredibly, it's designed for purposes of our survival to be responsive to what's going on. And so, you know, when you can, you know, grasp that, you know, concept, you know, I've come to understand that, you know, in order not to keep on reinforcing, you know, this inaccurate notion that it's all about the brain, I want to say, you know, how our brain and our body learn and develop in context. And I think this comes to my mind most acutely when I think about I referenced a little while ago, schools, for instance, that have these toxic school climates. And, you know, when you really think about the impact that, and you understand the impact that stress has not just on the brain, but on the entirety of the developing body, right? When, you know, in high stakes, high stress environments, the extent to which our kids' limbic systems are being implicated and are being overtaxed and overburdened. And there's a an author of a great book called Brain Rules that I'm a big fan of, and I got to see him speak actually about 10 years ago when I was at Chavez when I went to a conference, and he said something that it stuck with me and I think will forever stay with me. And he was referencing now what I think is a little bit more common knowledge, but still not enough in our systems, and that was we have no idea what the long-term neurological, biological impact is going to be on our kids of learning environments that are designed to generate overloads of adrenaline and cortisol that just courses through their bodies. And he helped the audience, including me, understand that those hormones were evolved in our bodies. He calls it our lizard brains, like 60 million years ago in our very earliest ancestors, right? And that was all about the flight or fight response, right? Like there's a lion coming at you, run, right? Get out of there, yeah. Right? But those hormones were developed for very short-term short-term responses. To get you to physical safety. They weren't developed so that you could continuously experience them and then now have your entire, existence being dictated by, lots of really damaging, hormonal, influences in your brain. And it gets, really, technical. But I remember that because, again, this is really about the entire body experiencing, either positive, developmental relationships and experiences and environments, or too often really toxic environments that then we use punitive discipline and we use measures to control bodies, to keep them in certain places, regardless of how this is really impacting their developing brain and body. And I think that is just frankly criminal. If we knew what these environments were doing to the neurology of millions of young people in a really profound way, I think more people would be up in arms about what we allow to happen in our schools.
And how important right in this moment, the notion of, what you just described, I think of as chronic stress. You can have stress that's like, a lion's attacking me and then your heart rate comes down. But if your heart rate stays, activated for a long time, and that's what many, not only children, but teachers are under right in this moment in time. Trevor and I being two of them, I'm here to tell you, just being under this chronic stress. And so this is a nice segue to your third point, which is critical mass. How do we get everyone to sort of, and it's like you said, we're equity, relationships, and even what we're getting at here, I think, is well-being, wellness, and well-being are having more of a moment, which is it's critical. I mean, it's not only good news; it's critical. And so, how do we get to that critical mass where more people think this is important? Think this is more important than, say, math and social studies?
Yeah. I think people, so one of our founding partners is a professor at Harvard named Todd Rose. Mm. He's written books, including The End of Average, and I think his newest book is called Dark Horse, about human potential. Really interesting. So he's done a public opinion survey, and he's found that what people in the public, what people want out of education has fundamentally shifted over the last generation. Whereas, 20, 25 years ago, an education was a means to, for most people, it was more a means to an end. I'm getting an education because I need to get a job. I'm getting an education because I want to, make a good living. I'm getting an education, for for, you know, I don't want to, this may sound harsh, but, you know, maybe more transactional purposes, economic driven, those haven't gone away. But people fundamentally want more and better out of our education system, not just the ability to earn a decent wage and a life, but also personal fulfillment and you know, being able to connect to their interests and their goals. And you know, it's become, you know, and you mentioned wellness, you know, really, you know, about you know, how to achieve, you know, a life worth living, right? Not just a life that you can pay for. And so he's found that shift has already happened. And now it's up to the systems to catch up with that shift, and to operationalize really what people want. So I think building a critical mass is actually about those of us who are interested and, you know, passionate about this work, you know, further building our relationships and engaging others in relationships whereby they get permission to think differently. That, you know, that we create spaces through our relationships to let them know it's okay. We don't have to maintain this, you know, sort of racist, classist education system that we have in this country, that we can change it. That in fact we know enough about how the brain and the body work to change it in very specific ways. And it's not, it actually isn't too big a leap of faith anymore, you know, to begin to move, you know, in that direction. And so, you know, I think, you know, building a critical mass is, you know, sort of growing a group of people who believe in something and then work to make it true. I mean, I think, you know, a big part of coming to believe in, you know, what we know about how to, you know, teach and develop young people best, and then, you know, acting on that knowledge, again, is about creating those spheres of safety to begin to ask tough questions and make hard choices, and be okay with that. And so, you know, that's what gets me up every day, is the opportunity to like when we're teachers, right? When we see those light bulbs turn on,
right,
in our kids,
right.
It's the same thing, you know, with adults, right? They need their own, you know, aha moment to say, yeah, I we can't go back to the way things were, and we're gonna, you know, make something, you know, perhaps new and different, and it's gonna be, you know, scary to any number of people, but we got to do it.
You really captured the dissonance between what people want education to be and provide, and what education currently is based on those systems. If I think about the sophomores I was teaching last year, and now if I were to have a very frank conversation with them, they would say that what they want education to be is exactly how you described it. They want a sense of wellness. They want a sense of well-being. They want to connect it to their interests. And because education isn't providing those things, and instead is still those more instrumentalized purposes you were talking about, they're under incredible stress and anxiety. You know, they talk about, you know, I wish that education could be this. I wish that I could just focus on my learning and just enjoy it. That's something that I really stress in my class is to, and I have been honest with them about the hypocrisy that I sometimes feel, because on the one hand, even though I do everything I can to not place an emphasis on grades, have lots of low stakes feedback, have conversations about why we learn, the power of English as a subject, the function of the humanities in helping us, you know, live well. I know at the end of the day, I'm hitting enter in that grade book, and they know it too. And they would say that even though every part of them wants to really just let themselves go in this participatory experience of just being and loving an English class, they know that, you know, at the end of the day, they have to think about their GPA, they have to think about their grades, their class rank, because they have to get into a good school, and because they have to get a good job. And these kids are like 14 and 15, and that's how they're thinking. So that's such an interesting, I guess, kind of tension. It's very fascinating to hear that that's what people are wanting education to be, because a lot of from what I hear from my students, their parents are feeling very stressed about where their kid is going based on their education. There's like this, I guess, kind of scarcity mindset about what positions are open in colleges or, you know, the best universities or whatever. So, yeah, I don't know. I just think that dissonance is something that I imagine is very hard to solve.
Yeah. And, you know, to those who say that, you know, it is what it is, or, you know, who really believe that, you know, you really do educate best through systems of discipline and punishment. right, and high stakes accountability and grades. And, you know, I would say that the proof is in the pudding. You know, it's not like our kids are telling us, yeah, it sucks, but it's really what we need. And it's really, you know, at the end of the day, yes, give us more of this, you know, gruel and call it good for us. You know, they're not saying that. If you look at the Gallup student survey, and it's been a couple of years since I took a look at the data, but I was flabbergasted that at the high school level, I think it was seniors in particular, and this is a survey that I think Gallup does every couple of years, with over a million young people, from like kindergarten all the way to 12th grade. They capture survey data, you know, from all grades because they're tracking long-term data, but found at the high school level that upwards of 60%. And at the senior level, it was 75% of students themselves indicate that they are disengaged from school. Mm-hmm. And I think at the senior level, it was something like 45% of 75% of seniors were, quote unquote, actively disengaged, which meant that they knew what they were doing. They knew that they weren't into education. And when you looked at the data, engagement in American public schools, I kid you not, peaks in fourth grade.
Oh, that makes me sad.
Fourth grade is when kids love school the most. And then it begins an inextricable decline all the way to 12th grade. There's no other bump in that engagement. It is just all the way down. And then you know what we see beginning at fifth grade as well? Chronic absence. And suspensions, and lots of other negative outcomes. And again, you know, it's no surprise, you know, why that is. And so you know, it really is by design. And I think that again, that there's no time like now, because at the end of the day, you know, when you have, you know, if your kids are sitting there like, you know, fretting, about a suboptimal experience in their education, just think about the human potential that has been wasted, and that is wasted every single day, right? That we don't center equity, that we don't capitalize on the power of, number one, relationships, and then constructing, you know, supportive, you know, another finding, supportive context for our kids, right? And what it would take to do that. And that is the experiences that we engage them in, and then in the environments in which they get to, you know, learn and develop. So the longer that we don't center on those, you know, just small handful of things, it's just incredible how much potential is wasted, and opportunities for learning and development just, you know, fly out the window because the system is pulling our attention to other things.
I really appreciate that you sort of started off this conversation talking about how if we did this and we did this well, it'd be best for all kids. And so I've had this sort of blog swirling around in my mind for about 2 months now, but Trevor and I are along with two other co-authors on serious deadline for our manuscript. So I haven't done it yet, but you know, my kids are, I have two white males and they are incredibly smart. Most of our listeners have probably seen them in videos because I use them in my video, in my workshops all the time. But they, you know, I have a master's degree. I have three books working on my fourth. My husband has a law degree. You know, we're highly educated. At the same time, it is not good for my two little white male children to go to a school that is not centering equity. And all of the things that we talked about relationships, about social emotional well-being, about the trust, about a sense of belonging. I mean, what parent doesn't want a school with a sense of belonging for their kids? And it is an active choice that we make. So we got to choose their preschool, and I was actively looking for social emotional learning. I wanted the preschool that was talking about growth mindset with 3-year-olds. Andrew was 2 when I put him in that school. And so this school was doing growth mindset type training with their teachers. I could see on their Facebook page. And I said to my husband, that's the school, that's the preschool they're going to. And so, it's back to the survey that you mentioned from Todd Rose. I can't wait to check that out. I thought I was an anomaly, but I can see that based on other research that I know about people wanting their kids to not just have a stable job. I feel like a lot of our generation, parents pressured us to have a job that was a good economic choice. And I do feel like now parents are saying, I want my kids to be happy. I want them to have a fulfilled life. I want them to be economically stable. Don't get me wrong. But I do want them to be fulfilled. And if my kids go to a predominantly white school with a bunch of predominantly wealthy kids, I do not think that is the best for my own children. There's my blog that's been swirling around my head for a while, because I do think that this is, my husband's first tour as a foreign service officer was Sierra Leone and in West Africa. And I went to visit the American School of Freetown, and I picked my jaw off the floor. I said to my husband, it is a Benetton commercial. I mean, these kids were from all over the world. And I just thought, I didn't have kids at the time, but I just thought, I would love my kids to be in that school. Are you kidding me? I mean, just what they would learn from, I'm like, I don't even care who the teacher is, what they learn from their peers, because the kids were literally from all over the world. And so I just feel like that parents, I hope more parents are thinking about that, and they're thinking about the value of diversity and what that can do for their own children's development.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think and what it's going to take again is these mindset shifts about what's possible and about how we can really rethink the nature of our system, because what we can't have is people feeling like in order to create equity for some people, whoever those people might be, well, now I have to lose something. Now I have to give mm-hmm. something up. Now I have to compromise, my standards or, what I want for my own kids. And I really, that's a false choice, I think, number one. And it really is, because, but what it takes is, again, being willing to say and understand that the way that the system is operating now is not set in stone. It's not the way that it has to. But it's also fundamentally designed so that somebody's got to fail. It's a sort of like rat race notion that has been so ingrained in our thinking. And in many ways, let's be honest, when we look at, and Julie, this, given your international work, when we look at systems around the world, they are not predicated oftentimes on this, winners and losers mentality that we have, in our systems. And, it's rooted in, you mentioned it also a while ago, right? That this overwhelming notion that there is this normal distribution, this curve that exists, but it has to be mapped onto everything that we do. And if it doesn't create this outcome of winners and losers, then it can't be quality. It can't be, what society, is going to benefit from. And that's just fundamentally wrong. Right, the system of winners and losers was predicated, frankly, right, on white people winning, on males winning, and on affluence and privilege always maintaining and actually taking more of the pie over time. There's a book that I talk a lot about, which helped me understand how the system was designed. You can see it, but you have to tell your readers. It's called "Someone Has to Fail: Zero Sum Game of Public Schooling." I recommend it to everybody, by David Labrie. He's an education historian out of Stanford, it's no surprise, right? The system was specifically designed to maintain white privilege and white supremacy, and that's why we have the results that we have.
And it's interesting to even think about the way that from that premise, all these other things are backwards, like sort of designed. I've been reading this book called The Patterning Instinct, and it sort of talks about different groups and cultures sort of develop this these sort of mental models and these frames to which they view the world, and which sort of ended up coloring everything else. And like even like thinking about science, right? Like, well, we extrapolate all of these things. We see like chimpanzees at some of our closest relatives, and they have this very hierarchical dominance, man of first man sort of way of engaging. And we just sort of naturalized something that is historic, like that is actually historical. We assume, mm-hmm. oh, it's that humans are competitive, right? That's just, it's our nature, right? Iron sharpens iron. And we create these sort of myths about the way that humans are, and we create systems based on those myths. Mm-hmm. When in reality, right. you know, there's more research talking about like bonobos, which are also very similar to humans who work incredibly well in groups. And that's why they're able to like thrive and survive. So it really is interesting thinking about how deep this programming is that we have to recalibrate in order mm-hmm. to fix the systems, because it goes beyond just, you know, I mean, like obviously policy is like an incredibly important part, but you have to change people's minds in order for them to be open to those policy changes. Mm-hmm. So the work that, you know, your group is doing, I think is massively important, because it's not just thinking about it, as you said, in these technocratic terms, but really it's a cultural and a social shift that we have to make. So yeah, I'm glad that there are groups out there in the mm-hmm. positions that you all are into to help make those changes happen. It's hard,
right.
but it's vital.
Right.
Indeed. So indeed, yeah. indeed. Is there a way for people to like join the alliance or find out more or ask their principal to join the alliance?
Join the alliance.
Where can our listeners find out more about your work and maybe about how they can participate?
Absolutely. So we're still building and growing our presence and our platform, if you will, but we do have a website. It is www.soldalliance.org, soldalliance.org. And you can go there now and download the document that I would point everybody to. It is called The Initial Key Findings of the Science of Learning and Development Alliance. It's a 13-14 page brief, which outlines our 8 initial findings. So it breaks down the concepts of malleability, potential, context, individuality, relationships, making awesome. Meaning, so forth and so on. You know, for you know, pretty broad audience to understand, you know, what are these key findings that can be used to influence and change, you know, practice and policy at all levels of the system. And you can join our newsletter. There will actually be a newsletter coming out next week. So I would encourage everybody to join ASAP so they can be on the list because, you know, in this moment of the COVID crisis and all of the attended, you know, impacts that it's having, we are going to put out, or we have put out, but we're going to amplify a blog post that highlights 6 key actions that we think, based in the science of learning and development, educators and leaders everywhere can take. You know, fundamental, again, focus on relationships and, you know, attending to, you know, every young person's individuality and malleability in this moment. And so, yeah, so you can go to the website and check that out. Pretty basic website, but there's lots there to consume. And I would encourage everybody to do so.
Thank you so much. Fantastic conversation. I can't wait to check out that resource. It sounds very cool.
No, thank you. And thank you for the work that you're doing and you know, keeping hope alive. You know, please do more of it. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Conceptually Speaking. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and are coming away with a stronger grasp of the concepts and mental models that help us understand our world. If you like this podcast, feel free to like, comment, or subscribe on your favorite platform. If you want to learn more or get involved, check out our website at edtosavetheworld.com and join our Facebook group, Learning the Transverse.